what we're going to do with the next and last, final two lectures. I had asked last time that people let me know, you know, what topics they might want to see covered, and there was sort of a topics list and so on. I heard back from exactly one person. You maybe? No? I don't think he's here, actually.
He's sick.
He's sick. Okay, well, that explains explains that. And then he said, let's talk about reconstructions, which is a great topic. But then I was talking with a couple of people yesterday at lunch, including Maria. So, and she said something that I thought was really helpful, which is, can't we talk about the connections between the sort of formalism that we've been developing here and others that, that you're more likely to have seen before? Like you know, the Pavia framework or Bach's world or any of these things. So I thought about that. I thought it was a great idea, but it was also yesterday. So I actually tried writing up a lecture to do that, and I found, no, I can't do it on that short notice. So I'm going to try to do that in some detail, if I can, on our Thursday meeting. We probably won't get to reconstructions, except maybe for some quick comments, but I have started writing up a set of notes on reconstructions, and so those will go on Dropbox, you know, even if we don't get there. In order to talk efficiently about either of these topics, I think it would be helpful if we actually went into a little detail about some of the things I just very telegraphically, you know, sketched at the end of the last lecture, which is the material that's in section 4 of the notes on probabilistic theories as functors. So that's what I want to do today. That's what I'm sort of the more prepared to talk about. So my plan is to start with a very quick sort of overview of what we've done so far, or maybe we can call it a recap. I'm going to propose, as I said almost 3 weeks ago, that probabilistic theories are functors from some category into a category of probabilistic models. And I want to make sure we're all on the same page as to what those words mean. So we're going to have a very quick, maybe world's shortest, introduction to category theory. So so we'll do that. I'll come back around to this idea of, you know, GPTs are certain kinds of functors, and that won't take, I don't think, a super long time. So we should have time left over for me to at least talk about some examples. And one of the examples I will talk about is Bach's world. That I can fit in today, I think. I'll make a point of doing that first, so that if we're short of time, I'll at least have gotten there. Okay. As usual, feel free to interrupt with questions. If that delays us, we'll just roll with it. Okay. So any questions before we get started? No. Everybody's okay. All right, so last time, no, not last time, last month, we developed a kind of a theory of probability, but a very general one, based on the idea of a probabilistic model where a probabilistic model has two parts, minimally. You could add extra structure if you want, but minimally two parts. It consists of a test space, which specifies some collection of experiments that you want to talk about, and a convex set omega of
of states which are probability weights on the test space?
Not necessarily all the probability weights, but some of them that you've singled out as particularly meaningful or relevant to your model. So let me just pause right away, ask if everybody remembers, you know, 18 or 20 days later, what all that means. Yeah, okay, so good. So I also want to remind you that we use this notation generically. Capital X stands for the total outcome space of big M. Big M is always a collection of sets. Each set is understood as the outcome space of some experiment. And so you union them up and you get the big bag of all the outcomes of all the experiments. And that's the space on which the probability weights are defined. Right? So that's also important in its own right. Okay. We also talked about morphisms of models. A morphism from a model, say M omega, to another model, say, I don't know, M prime omega prime, I'll just call it phi generically, is actually a mapping from the outcomes of M to the outcomes of M prime, which I'll call X prime. And it has to satisfy some conditions. And the conditions were, first of all, that if you have two outcomes in X that belong to a common measurement, then their image has to belong to a common measurement. And actually, I'm not sure this completely follows. Maybe I need to revisit this. Let's write it like this. If little a is an event, remember we wrote ev like that for the set of events, which are subsets of tests. So if little a is an event of M, then its image under phi needs to be an event M prime. So events have to go to events. That's actually a little stronger than just saying that pairwise distinguishable things go to pairwise distinguishable things. I have to go back and correct that in the notes because you do want this. And you also want that probabilities pull back. So you want it to be the case that for every probability weight, let's call it beta, in the state space of the second model, the pullback of that, meaning the function beta composed with phi, which would be a mapping from X to the reals, right? You'd like that to be, and here you have to be careful, maybe not a probability weight. It might not be normalized because phi might not take tests to entire tests. It might take them to subsets of tests. But you would like it at least to be normalizable, which basically means it should sum to the same constant over all the tests in M. So one way to say that is that it has to look like T alpha for some alpha in omega, where T is something between 0 and 1 and not 0. Okay? So it needs to sum to the same thing over all the tests in M. A consequence of that, is it a consequence? Maybe it's not a consequence. Let me just see here. Yeah, you want to add one further condition, which is that you want all the tests in M to go to equiprobable events. So for all E and F in M, you want phi of E and phi of F. Equiprobable. I hate having to think in front of a chalkboard, but every once in a while I find I want to do it. And it's always a bad idea, so I'm going to resist the temptation, right? To think even about whether these are actually equivalent. They might be, but it's bad practice, bad pedagogical practice to think in front of a chalkboard. Okay. I had a professor once who said that there are several things you should never do in public. And one of them is try to compute a homology group. And another one is to try to row reduce a matrix, right? You never ever do these things in public, right? Because, yeah. And I think thinking generally is something you shouldn't do in public, unless you can pretend to think, which is being well prepared, but you shouldn't actually do it. Okay, so anyway, we have this collection of morphisms between models, and it's pretty clear that morphisms compose and it's pretty clear that there's an identity morphism, the identity map is a morphism, and that means we have a category. We have a category of probabilistic models and morphisms. Which I'm just calling prob. And so now we've reached the point where we're caught up enough that I think it would be good to talk about some category theory. And the first thing that we should talk about is, what do you guys actually know about category theory? That will determine how much I say.
Not much.
Good, okay, because I'm
not much.
Good, so that gives me something to talk about. All right, so excellent, not much. All right, so let's talk about categories. Put this up here too. So start with, what is a category? Well, it's specified by two things. Some sort of a class of objects, which I'll indicate with capital letters like A, B, C, etc., of whatever kind, right? They could be sets, they could be vector spaces, they could be groups, they could be partially ordered sets or graphs, they could be strings over some alphabet. They could be actually just letters, big A, big B, big C. We don't care at this level, right? They're objects of some sort, objects of your attention. And for any two objects, or indeed, I should not say two objects, for any objects, A and B, possibly the same, you have a set of morphisms, as they are called in this context too, or also called arrows. They are also called arrows. Which you think of as, well, arrows from one object to another, and those get decorated with various letters to give them names, usually small letters like F. We're going to write script C of AB for the set of these. So in effect, you just specify a set of objects of some sort called C of AB, and you think of those objects as somehow taking you from A to B. Write that to indicate this. And finally, you have a composition rule. If you have a morphism from an object A to an object B, and a morphism from that object B to some object C, you should be able to put those together to get a morphism from A to C. We'll call that little circle, and write something like this. If F, for instance, is a morphism from A to B, and G is a morphism from B to C, then we should be able to follow them in sequence and get a morphism, which we will call G little circle F, like that, from A to C. All right? And just to sort of keep a kind of a running example in mind, if our objects are sets and our morphisms are functions, mappings from set to set, then this would be ordinary composition. Right? You want this composition rule to be associative. Right? And you want it to be the case that for every object A, there exists an identity morphism from A to itself, such that composing, say, F from A to B with the identity on B afterwards, or with the identity on A beforehand, is the same thing as just doing F, okay? Pretty clearly, the set of morphisms from A to itself equipped with this composition rule is a semigroup, because we said this is associative, and in a semigroup, identities are unique if they exist. So I don't need to pick one out specially. It's, if I say there is one, then there's only one, and I can name it. Okay? So far, so good. That's a category, and that's all. And that covers a lot of ground. So let's look at some of that ground. For example, one that we've mentioned is that objects could be sets and morphisms could be mappings. And that gives you a category, which is usually called set, like that, like in, you know, bold letters or capital letters or something like that. Another example might be vector spaces over some field. Let's just say real vector spaces for the moment. And linear mappings. That gives you a category, vect. And you could also look at maybe groups, and group homomorphisms. You could call that maybe GURP. You could look at topological spaces and continuous maps, category top, and, you know, pick your favorite kind of mathematical object. Typically, it'll be some kind of set with structure, and appropriate structure preserving or structure respecting mappings. That's going to be a category. So that's all well and good, but this notion would be a little bit sterile if we couldn't do anything with it other than just, you know, give fancy names to things. The thing that category theory lets you do is to compare things. And in particular, it lets you compare different categories by means of a mapping from one category to another of a special kind, and that special kind is called a functor. A functor from category C, let's say, to another category, script D, that's a D, is can't quite say I'm mapping because the collection of objects in a category might be a little too big to be a set, but never mind. It's a, let's say it's a rule assigning to each object A, I'm gonna do what I always do. I'm gonna write A and C. C is not necessarily a set. It's a, you know, collection of sets, a collection of things and morphisms. But I'm gonna write that to indicate A is an object of C. Some people do that to say, oh, that's the class of objects. But I think that's excessive, so I won't. Okay, so object of C. Okay, an object big F A, or you can also write that big F of A in D. So every object of A is assigned to an object of D. And for any pair of objects in C, and for any morphism F from A to B, you get a morphism from F of A to F of B, which you call F of little f, like that. So objects go to objects, morphisms go to morphisms, and you want this assignment to respect the only structure there is in a category, which is composition, basically. So you want the functor to assign to a composition of morphisms in C the composition of the corresponding morphisms in D. The sources and targets that line up to make this composition possible will be taken to the correct sources and targets to make this possible. And so this will make sense. It has to hold. And there's a final condition it's easy to forget. I've forgotten it on occasion. As applied to morphisms from A to A, this would just be a semigroup homomorphism. Semigroup homomorphisms do not have to preserve units. We want to insist that it should preserve units. So F of the identity on A has to be the identity on FA. So identities go to identities. That's part of the definition of a morphism. Okay? All right, so let's look for some examples of such things. A great one of my very favorites, is the construction of a vector space from a set. But there's a slight problem with it. So let's investigate. So example, maybe with a question mark for a moment. How about this? Let's try to get a functor from set to vect that takes a set X to the set of real valued functions on X. And if you've got a mapping from X to Y, well, that gives rise to a linear mapping. Oh, but it's a linear mapping from R to the Y back to R to the X. This is the mapping that you usually write as F star, and it's defined. I've done this before, but it's defined by the diagram that sort of looks like this. If you've got a real valued function beta from Y to R, you can precompose with F, and then you get your mapping here. Pull this back. The problem with this, I mean, it is an assignment of objects to objects and of morphisms to morphisms. The problem is that the morphisms seem to go the wrong direction. Fortunately, we can fix that for any category C. You have another category C op, which has the same objects, but the morphisms from A to B in C op are actually the morphisms from B to A in C. In other words, you just turn all the arrows around. Just put the little arrowheads on the other side. Okay? That's still a category. Composition is still associative, et cetera, et cetera. This is not a functor from set to vect. It's a functor from set op to vect. Okay? In general, a functor from a category C to a category D that satisfies the definition as I've laid out here is said to be covariant because the direction of arrows is preserved. And a functor from C op to D is contravariant because the direction of the arrows reverses. And both kinds of functors show up quite a lot. All right, okay, so let's see if we can find another example. There are lots of examples of functors in set itself. So for example, we can look at this functor, let B be a set, and fix it. I can use B to define a functor that looks like this, from set to set. It's just taking the Cartesian product with B. That's all. So an object A goes to A cross B, okay? And a mapping from, say, A to A prime goes to the mapping from A cross B to A prime cross B given by F cross the identity mapping on B. In other words, the mapping that takes a little pair, you know, little x, little y to f of x comma y, right? That's a functor, as you can check, right? So I guess the point here is that functors not only allow you to sort of change type, you can think of this, you know, if you're a computer scientist, this would be some sort of a type changing command. You start with something of type set, you end up with something of type vect. But you can also use functors to describe, let's say, natural constructions that you can make within a category. Typically, those constructions can be described in terms of some sort of functor from the category to itself. Okay, lots of other examples could be hauled out, and in the interest of time, I won't write them down, but let me just mention a few other functors. The power set, the construction of a power set, actually has two versions. There is a covariant and a contravariant version. The covariant version takes a set to its power set and takes a function to the sort of, you know, set-valued function that just maps a set to its image. The contravariant one takes a set to its power set, but takes a function to the inverse image function that takes a set in the target and looks at the pre-image. Okay, so there are two versions, two separate functors. If you like topology, the assignment of a fundamental group to a topological space is a standard example of a functor from one category to another, from top to group. Okay, let me just pause for a moment and ask if this is making sense to people. This is, you know, as advertised, very fast.
For me,
and a little shallow.
That clear when you say it's the opposite direction there with the when you set.
Yeah. Space. Like, what does that mean?
Yes.
So think of it this way: if in C I have this picture. That little diagram shows up in C, then in C op, it looks like this.
Okay.
It's the same F, the very same object. You've just chosen to regard it as going from here to here.
Okay, but in this specific example, I don't understand what
here
the direction why it's wrong.
Oh, because for this to be a functor, I would a covariant functor, I would need to take Rx to Ry by some linear mapping, you know, Rf, whatever it might be. This is like a candidate for a way to connect the two spaces, but it goes in the opposite of the direction that you would expect if it were a covariant functor. And the reason it goes in the opposite direction is if f is a function from big X to big Y, and now you give me an element of R to the Y, so that's a function from Y to R, I know how to put those together to get a function from X to R. But if the diagram had looked different, right, if I have that, how am I supposed to use F to transfer that
this one
over to here?
For me, it's the opposite direction. No?
Yeah, well, so this one, it's like, what's that supposed to be, even? Now, if these were finite sets, I didn't say they were, but if they're finite sets, then R to the X is spanned by all the point masses on X, and then I could use F to move point mass to point mass, and then just expand by linearity. So for finite sets, you can do it either way.
Okay.
Right, but for sets in general, you kind of, there's no easy way to complete the diagram here, so you have to do it that way. Okay, does that help?
Mm-hmm.
All right, great. All right, so the person who invented category theory, well, the co-inventor of category theory, the two inventors are Eilenberg and MacLean, Samuel Eilenberg and Saunders MacLean. MacLean wrote at some point, I didn't invent category theory to talk about functors. I invented category theory to talk about natural transformations. I said you could use categories to compare things. You can compare categories with functors. You can also compare functors to one another. And you do that by means of something called a natural transformation. So let me very quickly sketch that idea. It's a really great idea. If you have two functors with the same source and target category. So let's call them big F and big G. So they're both functors from a category C to some other category D. Then a natural transformation from big F to big G is actually a collection of morphisms back in actually in the category D, I guess. But they're indexed by objects of C. So it's a collection of morphisms little phi A in script C of FA G, pardon me, script D of script D, the set of morphisms in D from F of A to G of A like that, so that this diagram commutes. If this is A and this is B, so over here we're in category C, and if you have a map, a morphism, little f from A to B in C, then over here in D, I have two sort of images of this diagram. One under big F, it's an object F of A, and there's the morphism big F of little f, and then there's the object big F of B. But I also have GA and GB and a morphism G of little f between them, okay? So those two functors give me two morphisms in D. And the function of these morphisms phi A, these connecting morphisms, which go like this. Actually, I'm feeling like I want to be fancy today. Yes. Okay, there we go. These guys. Make this diagram commute. Right? So that starting with F of A, if I apply phi A and then GF, it's the same thing as first applying big F to F and then little phi B. Okay? So that's called a natural transformation. When you have such a thing, you generally write phi from F to G like this, and some people put a little dot over the arrow to indicate that it's not just any old arrow, it's a natural transformation. And then these here are called the components of the natural transformation. So you'd speak, for example, of phi sub B here as the component of phi at B. Right? That's a natural transformation. So let me give you an example of a natural transformation, just one very simple one. We'll see at least one more. So here's an example of a natural transformation. Here are two functors from set to set, two pretty straightforward functors. The first one, which I'm just going to call big F, takes a set big X to, well, let me call it A. K takes a set A to its Cartesian square. Right? To its Cartesian square like that. And the other one, which I will call G, takes A to A to the 2. Now, what does that mean? It's not just shorthand for this. 2 is a very specific set in set theory. It's the set 0, 1. Incidentally, you guys all familiar with this way of regarding natural numbers? Right? Right? So you can actually say 1 is an element of 2. Yes? It's true. Yes. Some people hate that. I think it's wonderful. Right? anyway, so there you go. So this is actually functions from those two sort of indices to A. And there's a natural way of translating between these objects, right? In fact, if you give me, let's actually go from G of A to F of A first. There's a natural mapping from A squared, or A to the 2, better to say, to A cross A. Let's just call it phi sub A. And what does it do? It takes a function, I'll call it little a. So little a here goes from 0, 1 into the set A. And I need to output an ordered pair of elements of A. All right, everybody with me so far, just as far as types are concerned? Little a is something that takes as inputs 0 or 1, and for each input it outputs something in A. I'd like to turn that into an ordered pair of elements of big A. Any suggestions?
Take it twice.
Well, I can't take it twice because it's a function from this set to this set. So if I write it twice, I'll have something in A squared cross A squared, and I just want two elements of A.
Function on 0 and the function on 1?
Yeah, sure. Or the other way around, but that would be a little, show-offy. So like that, right? There you go. This mapping is the component at A of a natural transformation phi from my functor G to my functor F. Okay, that's an example of a natural transformation. I won't pause to verify the commutativity of the diagrams, but you can easily check those. When people say things like, oh, there is a canonical isomorphism between these two constructions, what they typically mean is there's a mapping from one or one to the other that is actually a component of a natural transformation. I said isomorphism, so let me dilate on that just a little bit. There's also a mapping psi that goes the other way that is an inverse. Which just means every component is an inverse of the corresponding component of phi. In other words, I can start with the ordered pair and I can reconstruct the function, and you can figure out how to do that. When a natural transformation has an inverse, you say it's a natural isomorphism between the two functors. Okay? So far, so good? So these would be naturally isomorphic functors. Okay. Now, let's see. Going even faster, we need to talk just for a moment about monoidal and especially what are called symmetric monoidal categories. Mostly I'm going to refer you to the notes here, but the basic idea is the following. If you have any category C, then you can construct a new category C cross C whose objects are pairs and in which the morphisms from one pair to another are just pairs of morphisms, one from A to A prime, one from B to B prime. Yes.
Why in the example be before I cannot take A0 twice, for example?
You could do that. That's a natural transformation.
Okay, so it's not forbidden.
So it's not forbidden. That would be a different natural transformation, and it's not an isomorphism. It would be just some other natural transformation, which, you know, might be of some use, but. Yeah, but a good question. All right, so. All right, so you can make this product category. And that lets us talk about, among other things, functors from this product category to itself. So you can talk about, let us say, binary operations on a category that play nicely with composition. And it's traditional in this area to call such a thing tensor product, although it may have nothing to do with tensor products in linear algebra. Okay, that's just the traditional thing. Actually, McLean was more careful. McLean called it box. Let's call it box. Okay, so a monoidal category is one in which you have a composition, a way of taking two objects and combining them to be one object, right? Sort of binary operation. And it needs to be associative, not necessarily on the nose, but in the sense that there is a natural transformation that is, in fact, a natural isomorphism between that and that, of course. This thing has to be a functor, so it has to apply to morphisms as well as objects, and there's a corresponding statement for morphisms. It has to be symmetric. A cross B should be naturally isomorphic to be, not cross, but box, to be box A. And you also want a sort of distributive law, which says, this is at the level of morphisms, which says that F box, F composed with G box H, assuming everything here is defined, is F composed with G, box F composed with H. You also want an identity object, a sort of tensor identity, or tensor unit, usually written capital I, so that I box A is naturally isomorphic to A, is naturally isomorphic to A box I. That's, you know, the natural transformations have to be spelled out a little bit and named, but that's the idea. Okay?
Right, I missed. What is the equivalent sign?
No. It just means there that I'm being very loose here, but there exists a specified, it's part of the structure, natural transformation. This is actually a functor, and this is like on C cross C cross C, and this is a functor as well, and you want those to be naturally isomorphic.
Cool.
By a specific natural transformation that is, you know, named as part of your structure, usually called alpha, or alpha ABC, and so on. So see the notes for more details, but the idea is that you have this kind of compositional structure. Now, going along with this notion of a symmetric monoidal category, there is a powerful graphical calculus that some of you have probably seen even without the sort of category theoretic background. In this graphical calculus, you represent objects by lines or curves called wires. And you represent morphisms by boxes. And you write down things like this. I might have an object A. I might have a morphism phi that takes A to some object B. So I would write that as an indication of what otherwise would be written like that. And I might have another object, another system C. And if I want to talk about A tensor C or A box C, that just means A and C are drawn side by side, parallel. So this diagram would actually represent, I guess this wire you can think of as you know, without a box, as representing the identity mapping on C. So you could say that this represents A tensor C mapped to B tensor C, where the morphism is phi tensor identity. I'm writing tensors when I should be writing boxes. My apologies. Yeah, where the morphism would look like that. There's a convention that mappings from the tensor unit are represented by triangles like that, and mappings into the tensor unit by triangles like that. So you could have a diagram like that. And that would represent a situation where we are composing this mapping with the mapping from A box, the tensor unit, which is canonically isomorphic to A, into A cross C, which would look like the identity on A box gamma. And then on the far side, we're composing with something that takes this whole object B box C to the tensor unit. That would be just F. So that diagram could be written on a single line like this, or you could condense it a little bit more and say this is F composed with phi box id C, composed with id a box gamma like that. But once the equations, once the expressions become sufficiently complicated, these diagrams become very helpful. You can manipulate them visually in a way that gets progressively harder to do with these things written on a line. At this level, this you know might actually be simpler because it's relatively compact compared to the diagram, but for very complicated things, the diagrams are helpful. Okay? All right. So that's the whirlwind introduction to categories that I promised you. And now, finally, with something like 5 minutes on the clock, we can return to probabilistic theories. Question? No? Just okay. So, any quick questions before I go back to probabilistic theories? Okay, probabilistic theories form a category. Lots of other things are categories. A common point of view regarding symmetric monoidal categories is that they represent what people call process theories. Actually, a process theory is nothing other than a symmetric monoidal category regarded as a category of systems and processes. That's all. If you say my objects represent systems, maybe physical systems, maybe you know biological systems, whatever kind of chemical systems, whatever kind of systems you have in mind, and the boxes represent processes that take input systems and produce output systems, then it's a process theory, right? Mathematically, same thing, symmetric monoidal category, but the point of view that is emphasized here is sort of an applied point of view. Okay? So, with that in mind, definition, a probabilistic theory is a functor, and I think I'm just going to call it M, which is the usual notation for a test space, but I'm going to use this here as well, okay? Think of it as standing for model. It's a functor M from some category that you think of as modeling your systems and processes. To the category prob. So every object A gets mapped over to an object MA, which is actually short for something like MA omega A, like that. And every arrow in the category C, every morphism in C from A to B, gets mapped to a morphism of categories. I guess I have to call it M phi or something like that, from MA to MB like that. But often I want script C not just to be any old category, but to have this symmetric monoidal structure so that I can sort of compose things in parallel. And what we would like to be able to do is to use the functor M to transfer the monoidal structure on C to a monoidal structure on prob. Now that almost works, and actually this is something I got wrong last time, that almost works at the level of objects. You can so if script C box is monoidal, symmetric monoidal, then you can define, oh, sorry, I'm so pressed for time, I'm forgetting something important. I say that a probabilistic theory is such a functor. I always want these functors, these probabilistic theories, to be injective on objects. And the reason for that is I never want to say that two distinct physical systems have literally the same model. They might have isomorphic models, but I want to be able to tell them apart, even if only just by labeling them somehow. So, injective on objects. And Now I want to be able to define a composite MA MB to be, I'll just write MB like that, simply to be the model assigned to a box B. Because M is injective on objects, that's well defined. And actually, the functoriality of M will tell you that all the sort of associativity conditions and so on at the level of objects still work. But the problem is we want this also to work at the level of morphisms. And for that, we need we want this sort of condition. If we have two morphisms, F and F prime, that are assigned to the same morphism of models, then for any other morphism G, we want M of F tensor G to equal M of F prime tensor G, and similarly in G, similarly with G and G prime and a fixed F. If you do that, then this together with, I guess, this, these are boxes, damn it. What's wrong with you, Wills? Can't you tell the difference between a circle with a cross in it and a box? Jesus Christ. If you have that, then in fact, you can transfer the monoidal structure. You get a symmetric monoidal product, not on all of prob, of course, but on what we would call the image category, the set of models coming from elements of C under this functor. Now, that's still not everything you might ask for. You might want this to be a, this resulting composite here. You might want this to be a non-signaling composite, right? Not just some old way of composing systems. You might want it to be non-signaling. You probably do. So, finally, let us say that our probabilistic theory, well, let's say our probabilistic theory is monoidal if all of this works, so you have a well-defined monoidal composition. Then we're going to say that M is a non-signaling theory if MA MB is a non-signaling composite for all objects A and B, where MA MB is, again, defined to be the model assigned to A box B. And for that to happen, I want to remind you of how that works. That means that we have to have, for every A and B, a mapping, pi AB, I guess I'll call it, from a morphism of models, from the very simple model MA cross MB, where we restrict to the non-signaling states, into MA MB, which is M of A box B. What's that starting to look like? Well, this construction here is actually a functor from C cross C into prob. And so is this. This looks like components of a natural transformation. You want a natural transformation pi from, you could call it M cross NSM to M box like that. That's a very quick, clean way of saying that these things are non-signaling. I guess you get a weak non-signaling product, and then if you have product states, it would be a full non-signaling product, going back to what we were talking about last time. All right, I haven't gotten quite as far as I wanted to. It is 5 minutes past my allotted time already. What I'd like to propose is that we devote the next and last lecture completely to examples of probabilistic theories, starting with box world. Apologies, I didn't quite get to it, but right, it's almost there. And if I can work out, if I can figure out how I want to say it, I will finish up with Pavia, done in this style. Okay? So let me just take a quick survey. When you guys, this is a survey of all of you, meaning mostly Maria, because she's the one who raised the question. The question was something like, you know, how does this connect with probabilistic theory, you know, with GPTs as we've, you know, known and loved them, or seen them at least. And the ones you mentioned were, well, basically Pavia, and I think Boxworld was probably already on your mind as well, to some extent. What are some others? Like, take a convex set, think of it as a state space. Is that sort of an approach to GPTs you've encountered?
Yeah, I think in that paper by Marcus Mueller that we read.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just
a review.
Right. Right. So that, and that's a very common approach, is just start with the set of states, assume that it's convex, usually compact, or, you know, even finite dimensional, and just build everything from there. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you exactly how that works. That's easy to describe in this language.
There's also like a paper by Lucien. I can't say much because I haven't read it carefully, but he proposed like a formalism. He called it operational probabilistic theories.
Yes.
But I think he believes that when you talk about a probability theory constraint nada, GPTs is equivalent to his formalism.
It may well be. I'll ask him about that. Yeah, one thing that people do is they use terminology like operational probabilistic theories or convex operational theory, or, and they all are meant to convey, you know, subtle differences, and yet different authors end up meaning to convey different subtle differences by these same nuances of language. So it's a little confused and confusing. One of the things I hope that a formalism like this does is let you put them all on the same page, so to say, and say, oh yeah, that's this, that's this, that's this. So we'll see that next time. All right, so thanks.